More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. It is a long way from the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater to El Salvador. But writer and social work professor Jim Winship has made the trip many times. Winship has a keen interest in the challenges young adults face as they reach adulthood in El Salvador. It's a story he believes we could all benefit from knowing a little more about, and his new book, Coming of Age in El Salvador, illustrates what many of those challenges are. Winship will talk about the book tomorrow evening at Boswell Book Company, but first he joins us in the studio. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's really good to be here, Mitch.
It's a pleasure to have you here. Why do you think it's important for people in this country to have this glimpse into what the experience is for adolescents and young adults in El Salvador today?
Well, I think that there are a variety of reasons, but I think that we are far more connected than we often think we are. And in many cases, we know very little about life in other countries. One of the reasons that led me to write the book just came from an incident that happened at UW-Whitewater where I teach. And maybe 6 or 7 years ago, Walter Mosley came. Walter Mosley, the author of Devil in a Blue Dress and a number of other books. And he had just gotten back from Ghana. And he talked about, before he left, meeting with a group of young men there and said, the rest of the world knows little about your situation and cares even less. And I had just come back from El Salvador at that point. And I thought that makes sense. That really does make sense. When I talk about El Salvador, occasionally people say Ecuador. We don't know much geography here.
Well, and what do you think is at stake from the rest of the world knowing little and caring even less about the experience of people in other countries?
Well, I think in the case of El Salvador and Central America, that really became much more apparent and clear this summer when there was the crisis of child migrants at the border. And I think the fact that we live in a world in which everything except people travels at light speed, right, in that you can be in contact with people anywhere over the world through Skype, through internet, et cetera, that money and goods travel all over. And people less so because of borders, but still they travel.
Well, and I wonder if there's something to the idea of we don't care about this until it's on our doorstep.
I think in many cases that's the case. I was really hoping that the crisis this summer would incite or provoke, engender more conversation about the whole range of what are all of our interconnections and what can we do so that crises like this don't happen on a regular basis.
Well, and I was hoping you might share some of your own story about what first brought you to El Salvador and what's led you to return numerous times since then.
Sure. Well, I first went down as a Peace Corps volunteer in the early 1970s, just out of college. And in pre-internet world, I looked in the encyclopedia to find out where El Salvador was because I didn't know where it was, and spent 2 very good intense years there working with the city government of San Salvador, the capital, and then left and didn't go back for 30-plus years for a variety of reasons. There was the war that was going on for 14 years, and then with young children and a job, it was just busy. But I'd been looking for a way to get back, and then there was an opportunity. I applied for a Fulbright scholarship, a Fulbright grant, and went down as a Fulbright scholar in 2005. And I was at a small university there and made a documentary and did some teaching, but also did the first research project on youth and migration. I'm a social worker. I was youth director at a settlement house before I got into academia. And so I was really interested in the issue of what happens to the children when their parents go to the U.S. One thing about El Salvador is that at least a third of Salvadorans live here.
I was just about to raise that issue. I was stunned at just what the sheer percentage of Salvadorans who don't live in El Salvador.
Yes. And that was such a marked change from when I was there in the early 70s. When I was there in the early 70s, and again, I was a Peace Corps volunteer. I was working in poor communities around there. But aside from people who were very well off, I did not know anybody who had family members in the U.S. So there was a tremendous migration. It started during the war. And then after the war, the economy was good for a few years. And then it wasn't, and the conservative government cut back on public spending, and so there was a lot of public sector unemployment. And then that happened in the mid-90s, at the time when our economy was just booming, and employers were looking for people, and the border was porous, and so people came.
Well, and you raise an interesting question in this book. This question, in fact, it's a question about a question. You know, you ask this question, why do you choose to stay? And that question in and of itself is interesting that you even have to ask it.
Yeah, it really is. And I put this in the book, but because it's such an interesting question, I posed that to a group of my UW Whitewater freshmen. You know, I said, okay, I need some volunteers. These are a learning community, first semester freshmen. And so these four young women got up there and I posed the question, after you graduate from college, why do you want to stay in the United States? And they were kind of, you know, they were struck. They didn't know what to say because they had never thought about that. And Salvadorans who do stay and a number of people who could live anywhere else, really talented, educated people, do stay because of the country. But they all know. They all know the reasons why they're there.
Well, right. You write that there are many choosing to stay, even those from transnational families who have one or more parents living in the United States. So what are the compelling reasons that they are trying to make a go of it in El Salvador rather than attempt the migration to the United States or anywhere else?
Well, I think some of it just has to do with, you know, with just this is my country. You know, this is where I am. This is where I belong. The other piece is that even if there are family members in the U.S., there are also family members there. And there's family, and it's your own country, and it's your own language, and everything is familiar. And I think when people leave, they realize to some degree just how important that is.
Well, and you're right. There's a certain degree of happiness even in the face of not necessarily having an easy life that people are able to achieve in El Salvador that either they worry or they've experienced the opposite in the United States.
Yeah. One of the things that I point out in the book is that there was a Gallup survey in 2012 of happiness around the world, and El Salvador came up as the third happiest country. And the last one, which was 2014, it was still in the top 10. And I think a lot of that just has to do with interactions and greetings and hugs and in some cases, more slow time than we often find in the United States.
At the same time, I mean, one of the sections that is maybe the most revelatory in this book is the part where you essentially transcribe interviews with a number of El Salvadorans about how they're making a go of it. And it strikes me that nearly all of them face challenges at nearly every turn.
One of the things I did with the book, and it's creative, it's, you know, creative nonfiction. And trying to make it as readable as possible, but with a lot of information. But I wanted to make sure that there were other voices other than my own. And so the middle of the book is these interviews. And it's true that what you see is people who in some cases have struggled and are doing pretty well, in some cases very much still are struggling. But I just wanted their unfiltered voices to come through. And then I refer back to those at the various places.
Even for someone who has spent as much time in El Salvador and studying El Salvador as you have, were there things that surprised you about those experiences that you chronicled there?
In some of the cases, I'm in awe of the people. I mean, one of them is Douglas. And Douglas is somebody that I interviewed in 2005 when I was there. And Douglas is from one of the – probably the most dangerous poor areas, slums in El Salvador, had – dropped out before he got to high school, got a scholarship, came back to high school, went to the best university there. And when I interviewed him again in 2013, he had graduated. He is an accountant. He had gotten a job as an auditor, still lives in that community. And he and his wife named their son Gandhi. I mean, this is my community. This is where I stay. You know, yes, there are gang members. We know each other. Occasionally we play soccer. You know, so it was a part of just kind of settling into this is my life and I could live someplace else, but this is where I choose to be.
Education, you briefly touched on education there. It is a really interesting issue that you write about. And I was really taken with the story of one man for whom there were so few educational opportunities when he was little that he wound up going back to first grade as a teenager.
Yeah, this is Andres. And Andres is a friend of mine. He was a student at the Universidad Panamericana where I was in 2005. But grew up in a very rural area. We went with Andres to where his mother lives. So it's an almost impassable road to get there. There's no running water. There's obviously no electricity. And when he grew up, and his father was farming, that's what they did. You know, mostly frijoles. And Andres would go to school occasionally, but they'd have to walk 4 kilometers to get there.
And you're right that sometimes the teacher wasn't
sometimes
there.
Sometimes the teacher, one-room schoolhouse, and sometimes the teacher wasn't there. And so they gave up. But he really, really wanted to go to school. And at age 16 when he started, through somebody his brother met, he moved to another part of the country and started school and started literally in first grade with first graders. They had to find another desk for him because there was not a desk in the room. And so did that and then was able through some nights and weekends programs to continue through getting his undergraduate degree – I mean getting his high school degree and then that university, Universidad Panamericana, is a nights and weekends program. So it's mostly adults and so he came and did that and I think 5 days after he got his diploma, got the promotion to be in charge of health promoters in several states and it was one of those things where he just had to have that degree. But he's bright. He represents the health department in their emergency management planning for the country.
We think about challenges with education funding in the United States. Education has been really underfunded in El Salvador for a long time, both at the primary and secondary and also at the higher education levels. How large a part of the equation do you think education will be in improving the outlook for young people there?
I think it's almost difficult to undervalue that because I think what we've seen there is a tremendous growth in education. During the Civil War, which was 1978 to 1992, you know, in the countryside, you know, it was rare for anybody to have more than a third grade education. You know, now going through the first 6 years is almost universal. They're at 97-98%, and they're getting up to close to 40% of people graduating high school. College enrollment has gone way up. But the difficulty is the underfunding and then just the lack of quality. And in some cases, the teachers are overworked in that the normal teaching day is to teach a kind of a 4.5 hour day, but they do two of those in order to use the classroom
right,
buildings.
By the end of the day,
yeah, and if someone's doing both of those, then they say I just don't have anything left to give. And curriculum's outmoded, teaching materials in some cases are outmoded. Students get bored, and then also, and I think this is one of the things that's probably most important that I found was talking to social workers, teachers, health promoters who say that out in the countryside there is the sense that there are not opportunities in the country. And I would say that there are few opportunities in the country. But the difference between no oportunidades, there are no opportunities, and there are few opportunities is the difference between, okay, if there's few opportunities, I need to do this, 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 and this in order to improve my chances. I need to look for scholarships. I need to do that. If I think there's no opportunities, well, I'm going to drop out before I get to high school and just go to the United States and look for a job as a dishwasher.
What would you hope the impact of your work, not just the book, but the research that you do and that of your fellow researchers, what do you hope the impact will be?
Well, I think the one thing is you know, on the most basic level is just understanding. You know, it's just understanding. I think beyond that, I think to be able to participate in a more educated way in the public dialogue in terms of what's our relationship with countries in Central America and Latin America. I think there's also a piece in which – and this probably could have come through more strongly because in a book you always leave out more than – or realize later there's more things that you could do. But I was just also just very aware of the way that actions of individual churches and organizations and people just really made a difference in the lives of people. I mean, Douglas is an example. There's some other people who have had the opportunity to learn English and now are working at a call center, which is a pretty good job. And just all those kinds of things that give people the idea that I can stay here. I can stay here. Because when you go back to what you said earlier about why do people stay, you know, the other thing is that and now we're doing this interview and it's just a beautiful day, you know, but living in Wisconsin in January and February and March, when you compare that to living in the tropics, you know, where you're driving down the road and it's poinsettias, it's not Christmas, they're just blooming on the side of the road and there's a beautiful ocean that's 45 minutes away. You know, it's a beautiful country and I think in many cases or most cases, people wouldn't leave unless they felt like they had to.
Jim Winship, thank you so much for your time, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you, and thanks again for allowing me to come here.
Jim Winship's new book is called Coming of Age in El Salvador. He's a professor of social work and coordinator of the Latin American Studies minor at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. Winship will talk about El Salvador and his new book tomorrow evening at Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee. One last break, and then we'll talk with a South Milwaukee children's book author about two new titles that engage children and their love for animals. That's when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio.